Buglers, we are live from Leicester Square Theatre on the 16th of September with Chris Addison and Alice Fraser. It might be our only London date of the year, so get your tickets now. Oh, get them at thebuglepodcast.com. That bit's important.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the final Bugle Ashes Zoltzcast of 2023. It is all over. There is no more. There's no more Test cricket for months now. The focus of the world turns to things like the 50 over World Cup just coming in October, November. The 100 competition that I've been reliably informed has just started. The heat death of the universe and the general sense that humanity is entirely doomed. And, you know, I really need Test cricket to stop me thinking about all that stuff. And now it's not there. It's not there for months. And all I can do is just reflect on quite what a f***ing amazing 6 weeks this Ashes has provided us with, and particularly provided me with in my ludicrous job doing stats on BBC Radio. It's been completely joyous experience, to be honest, for someone who's been obsessed with cricket since the age of six. I got quite emotional at the end. Not the fact that England had won, the fact we've seen Stuart Broad dancing off into the sunset in one of the most fantastically glorious ends to a career. I mean, it was up there with Alastair Cook marching off with a century in his last innings against India in 2018. But Cook then had to stand in the field for a day and a bit while England bowled themselves to victory. Broad got to do it with the last ball of the Ashes. He took the Ashes tying. I mean, oh, no, we don't get the urn, but the series tying wicket. But it was more just the fact of having seen something so incredible over a prolonged period of time, doing the thing that I love most in the world. With all due respect to the other things that I do in the world, it was wonderful, to be honest. And to put in context, quite what an incredible series this was. I'm just going to pick up on a couple of stats that we've talked about through this series. One is close finishes. England won by 49 runs, and it was sort of closer than that because Australia got to a position where, with still 7 wickets left, they only needed another 120 before pretty much the first dramatic middle order collapse of the series. It was the fourth game out of 5 that has been won by a margin of under 50 runs or by 3 or fewer wickets. Now, there were no games like that in the entire 1960s and 70s put together, and in the entire history of Ashes cricket, there's been on average 1 every 14 matches, so that's almost 1 every 3 series, pretty much, that you've had to wait for a game like that. And we've had 4 in 5 games over the space of a month and a half. It has been a remarkable time to be watching cricket. And these games have been close all the way through. The gaps on first innings: 7 runs at Edgbaston, 91 at Lord's, 26 at Headingley, 12 at the Oval. Just the one game at Old Trafford, the 275-run first innings shellacking that England gave Australia in that ultimately rain-sogged game. The average first innings gap in all Ashes cricket over the previous 20 series was 171 runs.
Whoa.
So to have 3 games with gaps below 30 and 4 games with gaps below 100, again, that puts into context quite how unusual and magnificent this series has been. To discuss this with me, joining me for the final time, it's producer Chris. Chris, it was a fluctuating day on Monday. Australia came out having batted so well and not lost a wicket on the curtailed day 4. Warner and Khawaja having put together the longest partnership of the series. Suddenly, England had the ball they'd changed just before the end of play on day 4, and it turned out that this ball was not really a cricket ball. It was a piece of devious magic that suddenly this what had been a rather sort of moth-eaten, sorry bit of leather it became this hard-moving organ of Australian destruction. And there's been a bit of Australian complaining about that, which is sort of understandable, Chris, but yet another glitch in the narrative that just added to the dramatic tapestry.
It's amazing, Andy. Hello, by the way. Hearing Australia bemoan something like the mighty Australia. the World Test Champions Australia, number one ranked team, the team who win the Ashes every single time, who hammered England in Australia, moaning about a ball change. It's like they had other bigger problems this series that I think might involve some human beings on their own side who would probably warrant closer inspection. I don't know. Two cents on that.
But I guess the way you'd compare it, and you know, I've never used dating apps. But I've been fortunate enough to have been with my first wife. I'm in showbiz. Let's call it as it is. But you know, we've now been together for nearly 30 years. So I've missed the dating app. But essentially, these two cricket balls were like profile. The difference between a profile picture on a dating app of a 25-year-old Adonis and a 73-year-old arthritic man turning up to meet you in a bar.
I mean, I wonder, would the cricket dating app, Andy, be Spinder or just Bumble?
Chris, that is outstanding work.
Thank you.
Well done.
My pleasure.
Grindr, of course, was an app that put together people who really enjoyed watching extremely dull opening batsmen score 100 off 280 balls.
You talked about Gary Kirsten's double ton just a day or two ago. Definite one.
That's
for
right.
Grindr.
Yeah, I think he set that app up, actually. Yeah.
From watching it at home perspective, it was about 4:55 p.m. finally where things started to look like Australia weren't just going to go and win it. It was even with the ball change, there was still enough ebbing and flowing, and Australia having sort of done something comparable in the first test. It did. I don't know with you in the commentary box there, did you genuinely sense that the Aussies were going to go and win it?
Absolutely. Yeah. So not only did they bat really well until the rain on day four, and the rain sort of helped England come back fresh the next morning. But then they batted, having lost those three wickets, a brilliant spell by Wokes, about whom we will talk about later, who has generated some frankly extraordinary numbers. And Mark Wood picked up the wicket of Labuschagne. Then it was a really superb partnership between Smith and Head up to lunch. It was an absolutely fantastic session of cricket. The ball was doing a lot. The bowling was brilliant. The batting was superb. And the game was absolutely in the balance. Then the rain created another break, and there was a sort of long gap before they came back for what could have been a 47 over session if they'd got through it. It might have been the longest single session of Test cricket in history, or up there. I think it was a 4-hour one in the 1998 Boxing Day Test at the MCG when England pulled out an extraordinary consolation victory. Dean Headley bowling England for victory on that occasion. But then suddenly, a collapse, a Wokes and Moeen Ali inspired collapse to two delightful people I've been lucky enough to work with a bit on the radio, and it was great, and players you thought might never play Test cricket again. Chris Wokes has ended up as England's player of the series, and really the player of the series from either side. He didn't even play the first two tests. He's ended up with more wickets in the series than Jimmy Anderson, Ollie Robinson, who I think I picked as my key player of the series in advance, and Scott Boland, who was viewed to be a potential series-shaping
bowler.
Born
for English wickets,
English conditions. And Wokes, despite giving them a two-test head start, has overtaken their collective tally. Now, and also, we're talking about one of the reasons that Boland didn't do so well, aside from the way England play, is we talk about him being a good bowler for English conditions. We haven't had English conditions. The pitches haven't moved, the balls haven't done much. And yet Wokes, who is the archetypal England bowler in this series, which has essentially been a batter's series, has ended up with 19 wickets at an average of 18. It's one of the most extraordinary individual performances. And I'll explain quite how extraordinary it is, because being Chris Wokes, it doesn't completely leap off the scorecard. He got 6, 6 and 7. He wasn't arguably taking 12 wickets in a match. But it was, if you could call the second half of the series Wokes' Ashes, I don't think that would be entirely inappropriate.
It is weird, the emotions going around both sides of a 2-all draw.
Yes.
I sent you something earlier on, which was sort of my the Skinner combined 11, and I've been arguing with a few of my Aussie friends about it as well. I had 8 England players, 3 Australian players. Wokes, obviously, you know, in there at number 7 or 8, TBC. The most the Aussies would push back on was that they would have 4 Aussies in the team. Yet, it was a 2-2 draw. Like, what's happened?
Well, yes, it is quite a strange one, isn't it? And, you know, Pat Cummins, we did a combined team on the BBC, and they were a bit different about it in that they sort of picked the best number 3 from the series at number 3 rather than picking, you know, the best 3 players, batters about 3, 4, and 5. So we ended up with Labuschagne at 3, for example. Pat Cummins got in that, and now he's ended up with not particularly impressive stats, and, you know, took an absolute battering the second half of the series. Up to the Leeds test, Cummins had had 1 innings in his entire career, 96 innings, I think it was, in which he'd gone for more than 4.5 and over. Then, starting with that expensive 6-for that looked to have given Australia control of the Leeds test, since then, 5 innings, he's gone at over 4.5 and over in a row. So, his performance in the first 2 tests was a massive part in Australia being 2-0 up. So it depends how you judge performance. Again, you can look at averages. They don't really tell you the story of impact. Say Zach Crawley has ended up with a good average and a lot of runs. But as I mentioned before, his consistency has actually been highly influential. Even those scores of 30 or 40, you know, you have the 33 and 44 at Leeds, were actually massively influential in a low-scoring game. So, it's always hard and also pointless making composite 11s, albeit fun. But I think it does show how essentially England have been sort of battering Australia for 5 tests. Australia have gone rope-a-dope very successfully in the first 2 tests and progressively less successfully as the series has gone on.
For me, Cummins, and I would add Travis Head and in a similar way, Mitchell Marsh, is it not that, like, they ran a marathon at 5k pace, or rather they started it at 5k pace and then 3 hours later sort of vomited over the finish line. It felt that was more what had happened.
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it. It did seem that I don't know how many, because there was a lot of talk about, you know, the condensed nature of the cricket, and clearly it was very condensed. Mm-hmm. There have been, you know, more condensed periods of Test cricket, maybe not under quite the same sort of scrutiny and pressure as modern sport is played under, and all these sort of added faffing around with media that is required. And but England did definitely progressively get on top of Australia, and I think the fact that they had 2 fresh bowlers coming in midway through the series to make a huge difference gave them a significant edge in those last 3 tests. Shall we talk a bit more about Chris? Can we just have a Chris Wokes stat whack?
All day.
Okay.
Stand back. It's a Chris Wokes stat whack.
Chris Wokes took 19 wickets at 18.1. He became the first English bowler to take more than 12 wickets in an Ashes series at an average below 20 since 1985, when Richard Ellison, the Kent swingster, hooped his way to 17 wickets in the final 2 tests of the series at an average of just under 11. To find an England bowler with a better Ashes series average, having played at least 3 games in a series and bowled at least 50 overs, you've got to go back to 1978-79, Mike Hendrick and Jeff Miller, but that was against essentially a third-string Australian team. And before that, you've got to go back to Derek Underwood, another Kent player, left-arm spinner in 1972, took 20 wickets at 15.1. Here, for me, is my favourite stat of this Chris Wokes stat whack. The full list, Chris, of England seamers with 18 or more wickets in a home Ashes series at a better average than Wokes' average this summer contains not 2, not 3, not 4, but 1 bowler, and that is Surrey's medium-paced magician Alec Bedser, who took 39 wickets at 17 in 1953. And since 1989, when Terry Alderman nibbled England to distraction, only 1 bowler on either side has taken more than 12 wickets in an Ashes series in England and averaged less than Wokes did this summer, and that is Glenn McGrath, one of the greatest bowlers of all time, who took 32 at 16.9 in 2001. I haven't finished my Chris Wokes stat whack yet. I do hope you're enjoying this, Wokes fans. He took 6 wickets at both Headingley and Old Trafford, followed by 7 at the Oval. He's only the 3rd England bowler to take 6 or more wickets in 3 consecutive tests during a home Ashes series. That's after Bedser in 53 and Jim Laker in 1956. The only England bowlers to achieve this feat in a Way Ashes series since the First World War are Darren Goff in 94-95, John Snow in 1970-71, and extreme speedster Frank Tyson in 1954-55. So there you go. Here endeth the Chris Wokes Statwek. I hope that puts in perspective quite how extraordinary he individually has been within this extraordinary series.
Oh, he's amazing. And look, I think it was him complimenting Wood, like those two players in combination were dynamite for England. Then you mentioned Glenn McGrath and his amazing Ashes record. I kept flicking between, depending on what I was doing, the radio and the TV for the coverage. And obviously, you spent a lot of time with Glenn. He sounds like a fantastic man. You know, I'm not there to judge at all. He had a moment in the commentary just when the pendulum swung, sometime between 4:55 p.m. and 5:10, and it was on commentary of Isha Guha, who said something to him along the lines of, "It's looking bad for Australia, isn't it?" And there was just silence. And then she had to like, "Glenn?" And then all of a sudden he snapped into life as I loved it. It was like, you know, as much as he was being professional, you know, trying to be a professional commentator and analyst, there was something deeply Australian and hurt, you know, that was going through him at that moment as he couldn't even bring himself to speak, having probably 60 minutes ago thought, we're on for this now.
Yes, well, I can't actually remember that moment. I think when wickets are falling like that, I'm quite busy with my scorecards. Yep. And my stat was for like 4 wickets in 19 balls after a series in which largely bowlers have had to just chip away gradually and sort of wait for, you know, force things to happen. And then suddenly this spectacular cataclysm of Australian wickets. I guess having been 2-0 up, there was an assumption that Australia would win this series, and that is a fair assumption, because no team has come from 2-0 down to not lose a series since the 1950s. The last team to do it, to come back from 2-0 down to draw, was South Africa against England in 1956-57, and I think England were only the fifth team to do that. The only one team has come back to win it, Australia in 1936-7, Ashes. But even to come back from 2-0 down to draw a series is extremely rare. So, yeah, I guess, and also it's just been such an emotional collection of games, because a close test match does grab you by the soul, and I think by the end everyone was at a sort of peak of emotional exhaustion. Plus you have the Stuart Broad bowing out from test cricket. I know Aggers knows him really well, so that was quite a emotional moment for him as well. And it was, anyway, the whole thing was slightly overwhelming, I think, for quite a lot of people.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, you know, obviously draws aren't an acceptable thing in sport anymore. And
no,
as we found in the World Cup between England and New Zealand, they decided that they couldn't share the trophy. They tied the extra over, didn't they?
That's right.
So they tied the extra over.
Yeah. So what happened then was that, you know, I was on the TMS commentary then, and it got to the point where we started the super over. And then someone turned to me and said, "Andy, what happens if the super over is tied?" Because sometimes they ask me for things like that. And I thought to myself, I haven't got a clue. So I just made something up. I said, it's going to be decided on who set the most boundaries. Clearly, the ICC hadn't thought of anything either. The MCC hadn't thought of anything. They were listening to the radio, and they went with it. I mean, that's not factually true, but it might as well have been true. Because, I mean, it was partly because when people discovered that that was the way they were going to decide it, it made so little sense. Mm. That people couldn't quite believe it—the idea that you would decide a game of cricket on such a such an irrelevant metric, really. When yeah, I guess you could have decided it in one day cricket on who bowled the more dot balls, which you know is equally as relevant as who hit the most boundaries. But anyway, it was one of the greatest English sporting victories in which we managed to win neither the actual game nor the tiebreaker, and won it on an arcane piece of legislation that no one had read. You don't get more British than that.
And you call it arcane and irrelevant, but I would throw to you, there's one way to settle the Ashes now. Let's do a boundary count back.
Right, well, now this depends how you do it, Chris. If you do it on total boundaries, Australia hit more, quite a few more. If you do it on sixes, England hit more, 43-31. Which was, and the total was a record for any test series, the 74 total. If you do it on balls per boundary, England win, but total boundaries, Australia wins. So I don't know how you want to, I mean, if it's done purely on total boundaries, as the World Cup final was, then Australia have won the Ashes.
Did four byes count as a boundary in that calculation?
Oh, some of those, quite a lot of them. No, I didn't count the four. But if it's done on more byes conceded, England win. And Johnny Bairstow can take a lot of credit for that, yeah. For conceding more byes. I mean, most of them weren't his fault, as most byes aren't wicketkeepers' yeah. fault, which is why we don't really bother about them, bother with them as a stat. Any other ways you'd like to decide the Ashes? Because, you know, as you say, it's quite unsatisfying.
I mean, other than Wokes and Cummins doing something like some kind of beauty off, like making right. them, you know, do a swimsuit competition. Right. I don't know.
Are you saying who is the most clean cut?
Who is the most beautiful, fantastic looking, brilliant man?
Right.
You know, both of those guys, if my wife left me, I'd be like, fair enough.
Family show, Chris. They're not pieces of meat.
that being said, okay. I mean, maidens, wides, nobles. Is there a clear winner in one of these?
Maidens, yes. I mean, if you want highest proportion of overs in which you've conceded runs, Australia romp to victory. I mean, that would be quite a weird way of deciding a series, but they just couldn't stop England scoring. Yep. Largely because they didn't try. They set those passive fields that worked for them in the early games, didn't really work for them. That well thereafter. 34 maidens in the series. As I mentioned on a previous results cast, the previous record for an Ashes series was 56 in the one test Ashes series of 1887-88. So, yeah, I mean, it was quite an extraordinary achievement to bowl as few maidens as that. It was pointed out to me by a friend of Mark Steele, John, who was there on the Thursday, who was there on the fourth day. And Tom Vevers of Australia in the infamous 1964 Old Trafford Test, when both sides scored above 600 and the world started turning discernibly less quickly due to the absolute tsunami of tedium unleashed during that game. Tom Vevers bowled 36 overs in one innings for Australia in that, and that is more maidens than Australia as a team managed across five tests.
He bowled 36 maidens?
Yes, he bowled over 90 overs. 36 maidens in one innings.
Crikey.
England, it was, both teams got over 600. It took England 293 overs. I think it was not just the dullest cricket match ever played, or certainly up there. It's got to be up there. It's got to be on the podium. It might be the dullest thing that's ever happened in the history of humanity.
Okay, so on the exciting side of things, obviously we're preparing for, one day World Cups, the hundreds, the glory of all that kind of thing. Was there a game here where after the first 20 or 50 overs, any of the innings where Australia had scored more quickly than England? That's as legitimate way as a boundary count back, like score after 20 overs, score after 50 overs.
Well, if you want most runs after 50 overs, there were 19 team innings in this series, and the of those 19... England batted nine times. They have nine entries in the top 10 highest scores after 50 overs. but the first innings at Leeds, Australia had the edge. 220 for four. played England's 213 for 9. Ooh. Now, after their 224, they then collapsed to Mark Wood's searing pace. So, yeah, England, if you judge it after the score after 50 overs, unless you happen to pick first innings at Leeds out of the bag, England are taking that every time. And the gap between the teams on scoring rates, and this is, again, a stat we've been tracking through the series, 4.74 to 3.35 in the end, 1.39 runs per over difference, the fourth biggest ever in a test series, and the three series above it were all series in which one side got well beaten, England, Pakistan, late in 2022, leading the way, although the games were quite close. Certainly the first couple of tests were reasonably close, but then England got completely on top in the third test, but it was a 3-0 win, 2.18 runs per over superiority England had in that series. But it's way, way ahead of any other Ashes series in runs per over discrepancy. The dot ball difference, 15%. England scored off 40% to Australia's 25%, the third biggest ever in any test series, and again, the biggest ever in the Ashes. So if you're going on those metrics, most dot balls, bowled stroke faced, well, England comes out on top.
Well, conclusive. We'll have to write to the ICC and suggest...
I'm not sure that's but equally, you could, you know, if you decide it on fewest dot balls bowled in an effort to keep the kids interested, Australia take that. So, again, but, you know, if we're going by the logic of the World Cup final, you could just pick out a random... Just anything random from this series, you could pick out, you know, longest time taken to put on pads before fielding at short leg, because you've got to tuck them under your trousers, and some players are clearly better at it, or have baggier trousers, or tighter trousers than others. You could most clonks on the helmet. There was a lot on both teams there. I mean, they would be as sensible as the boundary count back in the World Cup final.
You could make the umpires umpire. They could make an official decision. We could just say to Joel Wilson, and, you know, from some of my WhatsApp conversations, I think the Aussies would say that England had that one in the bag. So. Andy, one thing that stood out for me was the age of players on both teams. Two England players officially retired at the end of the test in Broad and Moeen. Anderson can't be far away. Stokes is still working and obviously has no intention of going, but I don't know how much longer we're going to see him, Wood or Wokes. Australia, Warner, Smith, you know, even Stark is pretty old for someone who bowls at that pace now. What is it with old players? Have we just seen a lot of players for the last time? Or actually, do you need to be in your mid-30s now to be great at Test match cricket?
Well, that's a good question, Chris. There was a curious stat from this series. We had 12 players on the honours board. I think I might have mentioned this in a pre... I get confused as to when, where and when I've talked about these stats. I've been talking about nothing but cricket stats for 2 months. 12 players who scored either 100 or took a 5-wicket haul. None took more than one. None got on the honours board more than once. And that is unique in Ashes history to have more than 9 players score 100 or take a 5 in a series without at least one of those players having 2 honours board entries. That is a niche stat, but it does sort of highlight how there was no sort of dominant player, maybe apart from Wokes with his those stats I was talking about earlier on. But of those 12, all but 2 were 30 years or older, and Labuschagne was 29. The only one younger than 29 was Zach Crawley. Now, so we only had 2 honours board entrants below the age of 30, and since 1926, there have only been 2 other Ashes series with as few as 2 sub-30-year-olds on the honours board. So that, in a very niche way, is confirming your point. This has been an Ashes for the older, more mature player. Mm. But as we see across a lot of sports, particularly tennis, the nature of sports science and, to an extent, finance and physiotherapy and schedule management that we see with the England team does prolong players' careers in a way that it didn't used to happen. So it is possible that Chris Wokes at 34 is, in real terms, a 17-year-old tearaway.
Well, I mean, you talk about experienced players. I went on Crick Info to look at their list of contracted players, and it must have been some kind of a glitch on Crick Info because Chris Broad came up. So that is really pushing the ages.
Yeah, but I mean, I think to be honest, he deserves another go with England because he was one of the most ridiculously deselected players in English cricket history. If I may go on a rant about one of my pet peeves from the 1980s, Chris Broad, 600s in 18 months, three in each of two consecutive winter seasons, never got a home century, but he had 600s in 18 months from at the start of the 86-7 Ashes to the end of the 87-8 winter season. Then in the first test against the West Indies, scored a very good half century. In the second test, he got 0-1 and was dismissed on both occasions by Malcolm Marshall, who, as cricket fans would know, is basically one of the greatest bowlers of all time and an absolute poet and magician of the art of fast bowling. And then they dropped him. They dropped one bad game, got out by one of the greatest f***ing bowlers of all time, and cut from the team. And I think they brought in Worcestershire's Tim Curtis instead. It was one of the most insane pieces of selection. So if Chris Broad is called back now from his duties as match referee, and I think he's done over 500 tests as match referee, let's give him another go in India. So, well, let's wrap it up now. It's been, I hope you've enjoyed these Bugle Ashes results, guys. It has, as I said, been one of the highlights of my life working on this series. And, of course, doing these podcasts has been the absolute highlight of that.
You know, thank you.
Talking with Chris, sitting in a hotel room on my own at 1:30 in the morning recording a little monologue. That's really made it all for me. But I do hope you've enjoyed listening to it. I've enjoyed sharing my my experiences and my stats with you. And just to leave you with a few more numbers, it's another series, Ashes series not won by the away team. The away team's now won only one of the past 12 Ashes series. That was Strauss's England in 2010-11. Up to 2001, when Australia last won in England, from the start of the 20th century, there have been 21 Ashes won by the home team and 21 by the away team. But we have seen home dominance, which is a bit of a trend across world test cricket. In recent Ashes, obviously not home dominance in this series, but still, England ended up about five runs per wicket better off. Let's call it a home win. Here was a lovely stat which we were tracking from quite far out. Only the second series ever of 5-1-1 matches without a run out.
Yeah.
The 1998-99 Ashes in Australia was the other. Also, just to mention, I've forgotten this, on the last day, that Ben Stokes dropping Steve Smith, catching it and then letting the ball fall out of his hand as he seemed to be going up to celebrate it. It seemed like that would be a moment that would never be forgotten in Ashes history. If Australia had gone on to win and take the series 3-1, that would have been right up there with Fred Tate's catch in 1902, which all school children across the world still talk about. Bradman's failure to walk in 1946-47. It would have been right up there amongst those iconic moments. But we'd pretty much forgotten about it by 6:30 p.m. The Oval Test was a curious test in that it featured neither a century nor a five-wicket haul, only the 10th Ashes Test ever to fail to trouble the honours board, and excluding Renshaw and draws, only the second in England since 1930. I don't know what you can read into that. Almost certainly, absolutely nothing. Just to think back to the series and how wonderful it's been and how unpredictable it's been. I mean, of all the predictions that you might have made at the start, I mean, 2-2 would have been quite a widely predicted prediction. But aside from that, how we've got there, with, as I said, Chris Wokes taking more wickets than Robinson, Anderson and Boland, and getting the player of the series. Zach Crawley, who had failed to reach 20 in 62% of his innings in England's top three, the highest failure rate of any top three player who's batted 50 or more times in the top three. And there's 157 players in that. That was coming into the summer. And then he and Warner were the two players who reached 20 most often. Seven innings each. Warner didn't convert any of them to big scores. Crawley had that one massive innings in Manchester and then a good 73 at the Oval. But Warner had only made it past single figures in two of his 10 innings last time, and he was out for 11 in one of those. Since the start of 2021, more than half of his test innings had resulted in being out before reaching 20. And yet these were the two players who got to 20. Now, reaching 20 is not a stat that we care about enough, but I think it should be, because I think for an opener, that is quite a useful contribution. But again, that is just yet another statistical curiosity from one of the most unforgettable test series that has ever been played. Thank you very much for listening to the Bugle Ashes Results Cast. We will be back for the 2025-26 Ashes in some form, hopefully. Felicity Ward will be able to rejoin the team Ved, it's quite a long way away, 2.5 years. But I'm already very, very excited about it. The prospect of an England team going to Australia and not instantly collapsing in a heap within 0.5 seconds of the start of the series, as happened last time and various other occasions. So that's it. Thank you for listening. Do listen to all the other stuff from the Bugle stable, including the Bugle itself and the Gargle. It's a glossy magazine sister publication. Thank you to Chris for all his help with this. Thanks to Ped for producing the ones when Chris was on holiday. And see you in a couple of years' time. In the meantime, may the cricket be with you. Amen.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.